From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The capabilities of the internet have unleashed never-before-seen phenomena, particularly for corporations and especially in the retail sector. Brick-and-mortar stores have found their online sales eclipsing in-person sales, but the one major company that started out as a purely online seller has taken its aggressive retail practices to new heights. Amazon, which started out as a bookseller, helping to push independent and corporate bookstores out of business, has now become a place where a growing percentage of Americans are shopping for everything from clothing and shoes to groceries. But the price we as a society pay for Amazon becoming the seller of everything is one we may not be able to afford. My guest is Stacey Mitchell, co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, where her research focuses on economic concentration and the health of local economies. And her recent reports include Amazon's Stranglehold, co-authored with Olivia Lavecchia, and Monopoly Power and the Decline of Small Business. Her latest piece in The Nation is entitled, Amazon Doesn't Just Want to Dominate the Market, It Wants to Become the Market. She joins me to discuss it. Welcome to the program, Stacey.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So first, let's put into perspective how Amazon competes with other online retailers and other retailers in general. How much of the market share of the country, of the United States, is Amazon able to capture? How many people, for example, what percentage of Americans do most of their shopping on Amazon?
Yeah, I mean, Amazon has become a very dominant retailer. We often talk about Amazon as a retailer. They're now capturing one out of every $2 that Americans spend online. And of course, online spending is just growing like crazy, and Amazon is picking up half of all of that spending. They're also the largest seller of books and toys, and they're about to be the largest seller of apparel and consumer electronics of any retailers, online or off. But the thing that I think is most important to think about when we think about Amazon's power is to realize that Amazon isn't really a retailer, that its designs on the economy go much deeper than that. Amazon is really interested in controlling the underlying infrastructure of commerce, which is an incredibly powerful place to be. It gives it a lot of power over other companies, including the companies that it competes with.
Right. So Amazon, right from the start, did things differently, right? I mean, most online sellers or most sellers start out trying to sell products and hope to make a profit. But Amazon has for years, in fact, since its inception, put the idea of profit making much lower on its list of priorities. In fact, it has simply focused on dominating the market, thereby undercutting other sellers, and hasn't really generated profit. That's a very different way of approaching retail.
Well, it's a tried-true sort of strategy for a monopolist, right? You know, Amazon has, because of the indulgence of its investors, Amazon has been able to lose a lot of money and put other companies out of business. So for years, Amazon sold books at a loss, and we saw what happened. Competing bookstores closed in droves. Amazon now captures half of all spending on books, both online and off. And Amazon has consistently used this strategy of losing money. So when Zappos, the online shoe retailer, became very popular in the mid-2000s, Amazon responded by saying, well, we want to buy your company. And when Zappos said, no, we don't want to sell, Amazon proceeded to sell shoes at a loss. They lost an estimated $150 million selling shoes at a loss. Zappos, a smaller company, you know, tried for a while to meet Amazon's prices, but of course it was bleeding red. And eventually the board gave up and they sold to Amazon. So Zappos today is now Amazon. So we've seen this over and over again where Amazon has lost money in order to gain market share. And its investors have been very happy to back that strategy with the idea that in the future, Amazon's monopoly will deliver huge profits.
And you start your article in The Nation talking about a company called Gazelle Sports with a similar story as the Zappos story. Tell us about that story and why that spells a very, very dangerous trend for anybody who wants to use the incredible capabilities of the internet to grow a small business.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really gets to the heart of what the anti-competitive concern is around Amazon. So a lot of companies, and this is, I'm talking about independent small retailers, chain retailers, manufacturers of all kinds of consumer products, you know, increasingly, if they want to reach consumers online, they have to ride Amazon's rails. So the thing that has happened, you know, it used to be even just a few years ago that when people wanted to buy something online, they would go to a search engine like Google or another search engine. They would type in what they wanted to buy and they would get a list of results. It would include probably Amazon, but other firms as well. And they would go, you know, and buy what they were looking for. Now, over half of all shoppers in the US start their product searches at Amazon. So there's no way that they're ever going to encounter a competing firm's website in the first place because they're just going straight to Amazon. And so a lot of companies, and you know, this small running shoe retailer that I talked about in Michigan, Gazelle Sports, is one of them. You know, they built a really nice e-commerce operation. They're an incredibly successful brick and mortar business, but it got to a point where they felt that their only choice was to become a third party seller on Amazon's
platform. And explain that, a third party seller, because Amazon, there's a lot of companies that sell their products through Amazon because of the reason you were saying earlier that people are starting their searches on Amazon instead of at, say, Google.
Exactly. About half of everything sold on Amazon comes from a third-party seller.
And, oh, wow. And there's, that's big.
Yeah, it's amazing. So half is Amazon's direct sales and half are from third-party sellers. The sellers are kind of a mix. I mean, some are brick-and-mortar independent retailers. It includes a lot of major chains. It includes manufacturers, both big companies like KitchenAid and small companies. It includes a lot of folks overseas, China, India, where they're now direct shipping through Amazon into the US. So it's a huge variety of different kinds of sellers, but they make up about half of the stuff that's sold on Amazon. And what we've seen is that Amazon uses what it, the reason it allows these third-party sellers to sell on its platform is partly because it uses the data that it gleans from their sales, what it learns about what products are doing well, to then compete against them. So it learns about a hot new toy from the independent toy stores that are selling on its site, and then it brings that toy into its own inventory and makes money that way.
Oh, wow. So it's literally using the third-party sellers as marketing testers.
Totally. It's a way where I mean, just imagine from the standpoint of an independent retailer where you've built up this great brick and mortar business. You've been part of your community for decades. Now you have a great e-commerce site and that's doing pretty well. And then suddenly sales disappear because no one's on search engines, they're all on Amazon. And so you say, well, I have to become a third-party seller. Now you're giving everything you have of value to your biggest, most ferocious rival. You're giving them your knowledge about products and you're giving them your relationships with customers. And so what we're seeing is not a competitive market. I mean, what Amazon is doing is really privatizing the market. It's becoming this private arena where anyone who wants to exchange goods now has to do it within Amazon, within Amazon's terms. And that's, you know, really the heart of what is wrong with this as a model for a, you know, a truly open and competitive
economy. So you come up with a great product, you start your business, you feel forced to sell through Amazon, then Amazon finds a way to sell directly, and suddenly you're out of business. And all the work you put in to create that business, Amazon has reaped the benefits of.
That's exactly right. I mean, it happens not only to competing retailers, but to competing manufacturers. So another example, and this was first reported a couple of years ago, was a company called Rain Design that makes laptop stands out in California, a small company, innovative, very cool laptop stands. They were a top seller on Amazon. If you search for laptop stands, Rain Design came right up. One morning, the folks at that company got up and went to Amazon, and what they saw in those top positions were knockoffs, were laptop stands that looked exactly like theirs, but were in fact made by Amazon itself. And it had given itself top billing in the search results
Wow.
on its site. Yeah.
You also give the example of Birkenstock. People remember Birkenstocks became really big in the 90s, these super comfy sandals. I believe they're a German company. What did that company's experience with Amazon tell you about what Amazon does?
Yeah, Amazon, because Amazon isn't one thing, it's a retailer, it's a manufacturer, it's a platform for other sellers. It can kind of toggle between those different roles and squeeze, put the squeeze on companies in different ways. And so we saw this with Birkenstock, which, as you noted, is a German-based shoe company. They've been around for, I think, about 200 years, a really long-standing company.
Wow.
They had this situation that a lot of manufacturers are facing now, which is that there are tons of counterfeit Birkenstocks on Amazon's site. And these are counterfeit shoes that are sold by third-party sellers, some of whom are based overseas. So it's very difficult for Birkenstock or anyone else really to kind of go after them for, violating their copyright over the shoes. And Birkenstock, like a lot of manufacturers, has been pushing Amazon and saying, why don't you clean up these counterfeits? This is, destroying our business. We can't, you've got all these counterfeit Birkenstocks out there. And Amazon said, sure, we can police the counterfeits, but only if you'll agree to our terms. And our terms are that not only does Birkenstock have to sell us the shoes that it's selling us right now, which are its kind of more, its more major product line, but it has to sell us all its niche products. So Birkenstock is like a lot of manufacturers where, they sell their most popular shoes through all different kinds of retailers and different channels, but they reserve like their niche, their sort of smaller product lines for specialty retailers. And these are like brick and mortar shoe stores that specialize in Birkenstock, that help people get their shoes fitted, that provide all of this service if you have problems with your shoes. And so Birkenstock rewards those partners by saying, we're going to reserve a certain part of our line just for you. Well, Amazon doesn't like that because it wants that business too. And so it said, look, you have to sell us all your niche products. Birkenstock pushed back and said, no way, we're getting off your site. And that's the only reason we know that this actually happened, is that they went public with it. We have every reason to believe that Amazon is doing this to other manufacturers, including, it looks like, Nike. And Nike gave in.
That's what's been happening on the other side. From the customer perspective, Amazon is just simply super convenient, right? Like I will admit, as a working mother, it becomes so much easier for me to order things for my kids on Amazon where I can get a good price because I don't have the time to go to a store and search. And then if that store doesn't have it, I have to drive all the way to another store and search, et cetera. So it becomes a super convenient way for customers, for working people to not only have access quickly to the things that they need, but also to get a good bargain. What is the price, the bigger price that we pay as a society for all of this convenience that Amazon has basically catered to because they want to be the seller of everything? What's the end game here? What would it do to our society for Amazon to win this game of market dominance?
It's twofold. I mean, it's partly that Amazon is undermining our ability to make a living. And it's doing this in a number of different ways. One is that it's contributing to the loss of lots of different businesses. So we've seen a sharp decline in retail and number of independent retail businesses. We've seen manufacturers are struggling, especially smaller startup kinds of companies are really struggling because of Amazon's market power. And we've seen this drop in the number of new businesses that are being formed every year in this country. We're forming far fewer new businesses now than we were a decade ago. And new business formation, small businesses, this is where the engine of job creation comes. Not the businesses themselves are a pathway to the middle class for people who start them, but they're also the source of most of our net new jobs every year. So we've seen this collapse of the engine of job creation. And in turn, we have this economy that's highly consolidated, you know, Amazon and a few other big companies that really dominate, and they have been using their market power over workers to push down wages. So Amazon is pushing down wages in the warehousing industry and pushing down wages across manufacturing and retailing.
And because Amazon decides that it doesn't need to have profits every year, they just want to obtain things as cheaply as possible. That in turn, of course, drives down prices and wages.
Exactly. And so, you know, the story of rising inequality that we've been experiencing over the last 10 years, and with people, just more and more people with these precarious jobs that are struggling to make ends meet and in danger of losing that precarious employment at any moment, Amazon is really a central protagonist in that story. And so I think the thing that we have to wrestle with is, you know, the convenience as consumers is really costing us in big ways in the long term. And I want to just be clear that I don't think the solution to Amazon is that we as consumers, you know, it's about us changing our behavior, although I would suggest that people really reconsider their relationship with Amazon. It's that we really need to bring back our anti-monopoly policies.
Right.
We as citizens need to take on this company.
And I want to get to what government can do around it, but also stepping back, it's, you know, I said Amazon wants to become the seller of everything, but as you point out in your article, it's not just the seller, right? It's because it's constantly looking for ways to cut costs. It is taking over the infrastructure required for manufacturing, packaging, you know, manufacturing, ordering, packaging, and then delivery as well. The entire, like, start to finish of retail. So how is it, you know, is that essentially what Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, his sort of vision is, where Amazon becomes this gigantic entity with tentacles, not just in retail, but in so many different aspects? You know, we were talking about the postal service and it being able to deliver items. Well, if Amazon can create its own delivery service, then suddenly it doesn't need the postal service anymore, et cetera.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, Amazon, we talk about it as though it's a retailer, but really it's this company that wants the infrastructure. And a big piece of that is the online platform. You know, as we've talked about, other companies have to ride those rails if they want to get to market. But then there are two other big pieces of that infrastructure. One is the cloud. Amazon controls over a third of the world's cloud computing capacity. So a lot of other entities, including Comcast, the CIA, Conde Nast, you know, rely on Amazon's cloud services. So it's a similar kind of relationship in terms of needing to ride Amazon's rails. And then the third big piece, as you noted, is this package and shipping operation. So Amazon's really building out its package delivery infrastructure. And the idea is that it's going to be delivering not only its own packages, but those of other companies, that it's going to take on UPS and eventually the Postal Service. And become, you know, the dominant way that packages come to our doors. So we can imagine this future in which if you're a company, you invent some nifty new consumer product, you want to get it to people, you've got to sell it on Amazon's site, you've got to host your data in its cloud, and now you've got to use Amazon's shipping service if you want it to arrive on customers' doors. I mean, that means we essentially have a kind of king that is controlling commerce, and that king is Amazon.
And there was a very interesting article on The Nation a couple of days after your piece was published, written by Jake Bittle, about one aspect of what we've just been discussing, which is the Amazon relationship to the U.S. Postal Service. Apparently, there's a special deal that Amazon struck with the Postal Service to get cut rate prices. It's because they do their own sort of, you know, they do the packaging, but they do the sorting, pre-sorting. But the postal workers have an ever greater number of packages for Amazon that they're delivering. And the Postal Service isn't hiring more postal workers because it's basically getting so little money from Amazon to do all that delivery. So it's really squeezing our postal service, right?
Yeah, and it's incredibly treacherous position for the Postal Service to be in because, you know, as we know, not only are they not getting enough money to actually do the labor that's being asked of them, but Amazon has partnered with the Postal Service so it can learn from the Postal Service.
Oh, no. So they're doing the same thing to the Postal Service that they do to third-party sellers, data research,
exactly.
And then they're going to use that model to undercut them?
Yeah, so what happens then when the Postal Service suddenly loses all of this business that
Oh my
it's been,
goodness.
yeah, I mean, it's a real, state of collapse. I mean, what we'll see, and we're actually already beginning to see this, is that Amazon is increasingly doing its own deliveries in big cities where it's efficient to do deliveries because it's so dense, but they'll leave the rural areas and the more expensive routes to the Postal Service. And so you and I, will be effectively subsidizing Amazon, through the Postal Service.
Wow. So the other aspect of this, and we mentioned that you get your movies through Amazon right now, but of course Amazon decided, well, why sell other people's movies? We'll make our own movies. We'll make our own TV shows, which is of course one more platform for those who do creative work, and that's a good thing. But all of this monopoly, all of this ability to, all of this control that Amazon has is giving it greater and greater leverage to decide things for us, right? Isn't that also the sort of really scary future that we face? If in the end, Amazon is the one place everybody is forced to go to shop for everything, to get everything, Amazon can decide what it wants to sell to us.
Yeah, Amazon is taking control of our preferences, whether we know it or not. I mean, if you have Alexa, the home speaker that Amazon sells, if you have that and you ask Alexa to send you batteries, you're not going to get the choice of Duracell or Energizer. The batteries that Amazon is going to ship to you are going to be Amazon brand batteries. And so slowly but surely, Amazon is beginning to take control of our preferences and to steer us to certain products over others. This is bad enough, in the context of batteries or any number of consumer products, but it's particularly concerning in the context of books because that's the exchange of ideas in a democracy. But if you look at the books that Amazon recommends, if you look at the Kindle bestseller list, it's dominated by books that Amazon publishes. And that's, I think, really terribly concerning. We know from academic studies that if you are shopping in an independent bookstore, in a brick and mortar bookstore, you're about three times more likely to come across a book that you didn't know about that you would like to read than you are if you're shopping on Amazon. And so we're shutting down. There's really something incredibly important about having a diversity of ways that books and other products can reach us. And we're starting to collapse that into this single pipeline controlled by Amazon. And that's really, I find, very scary.
So how is it that Amazon is flouting antitrust laws in the United States? Because we have laws against this type of thing for traditional business models. We have a history in the country. It hasn't been exercised nearly enough in recent decades, but we do have a history in this country of when corporations get far too big that they become, they sort of swallow up everything in their wake, that the government realizes it needs to step in and break them up or stop them from acquisitioning everything under the sun. So are our laws simply incapable of, as they're currently written, of taking on Amazon?
We have the laws that we need, I think, by and large, on the books, laws that were adopted, beginning about 100 years ago and into the 1930s and 40s. Those laws are very strong. The problem is that beginning in the 1980s, we changed how we interpret those laws and how we choose to enforce them. And what happened is that it used to be that antitrust was concerned with a broad range of things. How did consolidation impact workers and wages? How did it impact democracy and the flow of ideas? Those were the thing, those were parts of how we approached enforcing antitrust laws. And in the 1980s, that was all collapsed into a single concern, which is greater efficiency and potentially the ability to deliver lower prices. And so we began to look at, say, mergers or look at the power of a dominant company like Amazon and say, well, it doesn't really matter if they have all this power and if they're knocking out all the competition. If it seems like they're delivering lower prices for consumers, then we don't care. And as we've been talking about, I think there are real dangers of Amazon's dominance just for us as consumers, but there are also this host of other ways in which they're affecting the economy that really hurt us. So the good news is that there is a movement now with a growing number of lawmakers and scholars and others and ordinary people saying, we need to revisit that approach to antitrust and remember that this is really about liberty, equality, democracy. It's really about the core values of the country, and that the role of antitrust is to disperse power, and that that's really critical to democracy. I think we need to bring back that original focus to how we approach our antitrust laws.
Right. I mean, if you have one corporation controlling everything, this whole idea of small businesses that lawmakers from both parties like to, claim they help, disappears, and suddenly you just don't, suddenly we're all working for Amazon. Stacey, where can people find out more about the work you do at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance?
Yeah, so our website is ilsr.org. You can just search for Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and you'll find a wealth of resources on Amazon and our work supporting local economies.
That's ilsr.org. We'll post a link to that from our site later today. Thank you so much, Stacey.
Thank you.
Stacey Mitchell is the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and she has a new piece in The Nation magazine, which we'll also post a link to. It's called Amazon Doesn't Just Want to Dominate the Market, It Wants to Become the Market. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.